wondrous time in his youth and the place where his life changed forever. He shoved his hands in his pockets and tilted his face to the sky.
"Why," said a voice, "if it isn't Antane, back to visit us at last."
The voice was pleasant enough, though there was, Antane realized, a bit of a growl buried so deeply in the voice that it was difficult to hear.
"Hello, Sister Ignatia," he said, bowing low. "I am surprised to see you out of your study. Can it be that your wondrous curiosities have finally loosened their grip?"
It was the first time they had exchanged words face to face since he was injured, years now. Their correspondence had consisted of terse notes, hers likely penned by one of the other sisters and signed by Sister Ignatia. She had never bothered to check on him, not once, since he was injured. He tasted something bitter in his mouth. He swallowed it down to keep himself from grimacing.
"Oh, no," she said airily. "Curiosity is the curse of the clever, or perhaps cleverness is the curse of the curious. In any case, I am never lacking for either, I'm afraid, which does keep me rather busy. But I do find that tending my herb garden gives me some amount of comfort." She held up her hand. "Mind you don't touch any leaves or flowers, and maybe not the dirt either, not without gloves. Many of these herbs are deadly poisonous. Aren't they pretty?"
"Quite," Antane said. But he wasn't thinking much about the herbs.
"And what brings you here?" Sister Ignatia said, narrowing her eyes as Antane's gaze drifted back up to the window where the madwoman lived.
Antane sighed. He looked back at Sister Ignatia. Garden dirt caked her work gloves. Sweat and sunshine slicked her face. She had a sated look about her, as if she had just eaten the most wonderful meal in the world and was now quite full. But she couldn't have. She had been working outside. Antane cleared his throat.
"I wanted to tell you in person that I would not be able to build you the desk you requested for another 6 months, or perhaps a year," Antane said.
This was a lie. The design was fairly simple, and the wood required was easily obtainable from the managed forest on the western side of the Protectorate.
"Nonsense," Sister Ignatia said. "Surely you can make some rearrangements. The sisters are practically family."
Antane shook his head, let his eyes drift back to the window. He had not really seen the madwoman, not up close anyway, since the bird attack, but he saw her every night in his dreams. Sometimes she was in the rafters, sometimes she was in her cell. Sometimes she was riding the backs of a flock of paper birds and vanishing into the night.
He gave Sister Ignatia half a smile. "Family?" he said. "Madam, I believe you have met my family."
Sister Ignatia pretended to wave the comment away, but she pressed her lips together, suppressing a grin. Antane glanced back at the window. The madwoman stood at the narrow window. Her body was little more than a shadow. He saw her hand reach through the bars, and a bird fluttered near, nestling in her palm. The bird was made of paper. He could hear the dry rustle of its wings from where he stood.
Antane shivered.
"What are you looking at?" Sister Ignatia said.
"Nothing," Antane lied. "I see nothing."
"My dear boy, is there something the matter?"
He looked at the ground.
"Good luck with the garden."
"Before you go, Antane, why don't you do us a favor, since we cannot entice you to apply your clever hands to the making of beautiful things, no matter how many times we ask?"
"Madam, I—"
"You there!" Sister Ignatia called. Her voice instantly took on a much harsher tone. "Have you finished packing, girl?"
"Yes, sister," came a voice inside the garden shed, a clear, bright voice like a bell.
Antane felt his heart ring. "That voice," he thought, "I remember that voice." He hadn't heard it since they were in school all those years ago.
"Excellent."
She turned to Antane, her words honeyed once again.
"We have a novice who has opted not to apply herself to an elevated life of study and contemplation, and has decided to re-enter the larger world, foolish thing."
Antane was shocked.
he faltered.
That never happens.
Indeed, it never does. And it will not ever again. I must have been deluded when she first came to us wanting to enter our order. I shall be more discerning next time.
A young woman emerged from the garden shed. She wore a plain shift dress that likely fit her when she first entered the tower shortly after her 13th birthday, but she had grown taller, and it barely covered her knees. She wore a pair of men's boots, patched and worn and lopsided, that she must have borrowed from one of the groundskeepers. She smiled, and even her freckles seemed to shine.
"Hello, Antaine," Athene said gently. "It has been a long time."
Antaine felt the world tilt under his feet. Athene turned to Sister Ignatia.
"We knew one another at school."
"She never talked to me," Antaine said in a hoarse whisper, tilting his face to the ground. His scars burned. "No girls did."
Her eyes glittered and her mouth unfurled into a smile.
"Is that so? I remember differently."
She looked at him, at his scars. She looked right at him, and she didn't look away, and she didn't flinch. Even his mother flinched. His own mother.
"Well," he said, "to be fair, I didn't talk to any girls. I still don't, really. You should hear my mother go on about it."
Athene laughed. Antaine thought he might faint.
"Will you please help our little disappointment carry her things? Her brothers have gotten themselves ill, and her parents are dead. I would like all evidence of this fiasco removed as quickly as possible."
If any of this bothered Athene, she did not show it.
"Thank you, sister, for everything," she said, her voice as smooth and sweet as cream. "I am ever so much more than I was when I walked in through that door."
"And ever so much less than you could have been," Sister Ignatia snapped. "The youth!"
She threw up her hands.
"If we cannot bear them, how can they possibly bear themselves?"
She turned to Antaine.
"You will help, won't you? The girl doesn't have the decency to show even the tiniest modicum of sorrow for her actions."
The head sister's eyes went black for a moment, as though she was terribly hungry. She squinted and frowned, and the blackness vanished. Perhaps Antaine had imagined it.
"I cannot tolerate another second in her company."
"Of course, sister," he whispered. Antaine swallowed. There seemed to be sand in his mouth. He did his best to recover himself.
"I am ever at your service."
"Always."
Sister Ignatia turned and stalked away, muttering as she went.
"I would rethink that stance if I were you," Athene muttered to Antaine. He turned, and she gave him another broad smile.
"Thank you for helping me. You always were the kindest boy I ever knew. Come, let's get out of here as quickly as possible. After all these years, the sisters still give me the shivers."
She laid her hand on Antaine's arm and led him to her bundles in the garden shed. Her fingers were calloused and her hands were strong, and Antaine felt something flutter in his chest. A shiver at first, and then a powerful lift and beat, like the wings of a bird, flying high over the forest and skimming the top of the sky.
Chapter 16, in which there is ever so much paper.
The madwoman in the tower could not remember her own name. She could remember no one's name. What was a name, anyway? You can't hold it. You can't smell it. You can't rock it to sleep. You can't whisper your love to it over and over and over again. There once was a name that she treasured above all others, but it had flown away like a bird, and she could not coax it back. There were so many things that flew away, names, memories, her own knowledge of herself. There was a time, she knew, that she was smart, capable, kind, loving, and loved. There was a time when her feet fit neatly on the curve of the earth and her thoughts stacked evenly, one on top of the other in the cupboards of her mind. But her feet had not felt the earth in ever so long, and her thoughts had been replaced by whirlwinds and storms that swept all her cupboards bare, possibly forever. She could remember only the touch of paper. She was hungry for paper. At night she dreamed of the dry smoothness of the sheaf, the painful bite of the edge. She dreamed of the slip of ink into the deepening white. She dreamed of paper birds and paper stars and paper skies. She dreamed of a paper moon hovering over paper cities and paper forests and paper people. A world of paper, a universe of paper. She dreamed of oceans of ink and forests of quills and an endless bog of words. She dreamed of all of it in abundance. She didn't only dream of paper, she had it, too. No one knew how. Every day the Sisters of the Star entered her room and cleared away the maps that she had drawn and the words that she had written without ever bothering to read them. They tutted and scolded and swept it all away, but every day she found herself once again awash in paper and quills and ink. She had all that she needed. A map. She drew a map. She could see it as plain as day. "She is here," she wrote. "She is here. She is here. She is here." "Who is here?" the young man asked over and over again. First, his face was young and fine and clear. Then it was red and angry and bleeding. Eventually, the cuts from the paper birds healed and became scars, first purple, then pink, then white. They made a map. The madwoman wondered if he could see it, or if he understood what it meant. She wondered if anyone could, or if such things were intelligible to her alone. Was she alone mad, or had the world gone mad with her? She was in no position to say. She wanted to pin him down and write, "She is here," right where his cheekbone met his earlobe. She wanted to make him understand. "Who is here?" She could feel him wondering as he stared at the tower from the ground. "Don't you see?" she wanted to shout back. But she didn't. Her words were jumbled. She didn't know if anything that came out of her mouth made any sense. Each day she released paper birds out the window. Sometimes one, sometimes ten. Each one had a map in its heart. "She is here," in the heart of a robin. "She is here," in the heart of a crane. "She is here, she is here, she is here," in the hearts of a falcon and a kingfisher and a swan. Her birds didn't go very far, not at first. She watched from her window as people reached down and picked them up from the ground nearby. She watched the people gaze up at the tower. She watched them shake their heads. She heard them say, "The poor, poor thing," and clutch their loved ones a little more closely as though madness was contagious. And maybe they were right, maybe it was. No one looked at the words or the maps. They just crumpled the paper, probably to pulp it and make it new paper. The madwoman couldn't blame them. Paper was expensive, or it was for most people. She got it easily enough. She just reached through the gaps of the world, pulling out leaf after leaf. Each leaf was a map. Each leaf was a bird. Each leaf she launched into the sky. She sat on the floor of her cell. Her fingers found paper. Her fingers found quill and ink. She didn't ask how. She just drew the map. Sometimes she drew the map as she slept. The young man was coming closer. She could feel his footsteps. Soon he would stop a good ways away and stare up, a question mark curling over his heart. She watched him grow from youth to artisan to business owner to a man in love. Still the same question. She folded the paper into the shape of a hawk. She let it rest on her hand for a moment, watched it begin to shiver and itch. She let it launch itself into the sky. She stared out the window. The paper bird had been lamed. She had rushed too quickly and didn't fold it properly. The poor thing would not survive. It landed on the ground, struggling mightily, right in front of the young man with scars on his face. He paused. He stepped on the bird's neck with his foot. Compassion or revenge? Sometimes the two were the same. The madwoman pressed her hand to her mouth, the touch of her fingers as light as paper.
She tried to see his face, but he was in shadow. Not that it mattered. She knew his face as well as she knew her own. She could follow the curve of each scar with her fingers in the dark. She watched him pause, unfold the bird, and stare at the drawing she had done. She watched his eyes lift to the tower and then arc slowly across the sky and land on the forest, and then look at the map once again. She pressed her hand to her chest and felt her sorrow, the merciless density of it, like a black hole in her heart, swallowing the light. Perhaps it had always been so. Her life in the tower felt infinite. Sometimes she felt she had been imprisoned since the beginning of the world. And in one profound, sudden flash, she felt it transform. "Hope," her heart said. "Hope," the sky said. "Hope," said the bird in the young man's hand and the look in his eye. "Hope and light and motion," her soul whispered. "Hope and formation and fusion. Hope and heat and accretion. The miracle of gravity, the miracle of transformation. Each precious thing is destroyed and each precious thing is saved. Hope, hope, hope." Her sorrow was gone. Only hope remained. She felt it radiate outward, filling the tower, the town, the whole world. And in that moment, she heard the head sister cry out in pain. Chapter 17, in which there is a crack in the nut. Luna thought she was ordinary. She thought she was loved. She was half right. She was a girl of 5, and later she was 7, and later she was, incredibly, 11. It was a fine thing indeed, Luna thought, being 11. She loved the symmetry of it and the lack of symmetry. 11 was a number that was visually even, but functionally not. It looked one way and behaved in quite another, just like most 11-year-olds, or so she assumed. Her association with other children was always limited to her grandmother's visits to the free cities, and only the visits on which Luna was permitted to come. Sometimes her grandmother went without her, and every year, Luna found it more and more enraging. She was 11, after all. She was both even and odd. She was ready to be many things at once. Child, grown-up, poet, engineer, botanist, dragon. The list went on. That she was barred from some journeys and not others was increasingly galling, and she said so, often and loudly. When her grandmother was away, Luna spent most of her time in the workshop. It was filled with books about metals and rocks and water, books about flowers and mosses and edible plants, books about animal biology and animal behavior and animal husbandry, books about the theories and principles of mechanics. But Luna's favorite books were the ones about astronomy. The moon, especially. She loved the moon so much, she wanted to wrap her arms around it and sing to it. She wanted to gather every morsel of moonlight into a great bowl and drink it dry. She had a hungry mind, an itchy curiosity, and a knack for drawing, building, and fashioning. Her fingers had a mind of their own. "Do you see, Glerk?" she said, showing off her mechanical cricket made of polished wood and glass eyes and tiny metal legs attached to springs. It hopped, it skittered, it reached, it grabbed. It could even sing. Right now, Luna said it just so, and the cricket began to turn the pages of a book. Glerk wrinkled his great, damp nose. "It turns pages," she says. "Of a book. Has there ever been a cleverer cricket?"
"But it's just turning the pages willy-nilly," he said. "It isn't as though it is reading the book, and even if it was, it wouldn't be reading at the same time as you. How would it know when to approach the page and turn it?"
He was just needling her, of course. In truth, he was very impressed. But as he had told her 1,000 times, he couldn't possibly be impressed at every impressive thing that she ever did. He might find that his heart had swelled beyond its capacity and sent him out of the world entirely. Luna stamped her foot.
Of course it can't read. It turns the page when I tell it to turn the page.
She folded her arms across her chest and gave her swamp monster what she hoped was a hard look.
I think you are both right, Furion said, trying to make peace. I love foolish things. I'm clever things. I love all the things.
Hush, Furion, both girl and swamp monster said as one.
It takes longer to position your cricket to turn the page than it does to actually turn the page on your own. Why not simply turn the page?
Lurk worried that he had already taken the joke too far. He picked up Luna in his forearms and positioned her at the top of his top right shoulder. She rolled her eyes and climbed back down.
Because then there wouldn't be a cricket.
Luna's chest felt prickly. Her whole body felt prickly. She had been prickly all day.
Where's Grandmama? She asked.
You know where she is, Lurk said. She will be back next week.
I dislike next week. I wish she was back today.
The poet tells us that impatience belongs to small things, fleas, tadpoles, and fruit flies. You, my love, are ever so much more than a fruit fly.
I dislike the poet as well. He can boil his head.
These words cut Glurk to his core. He pressed his four hands to his heart and fell down heavily upon his great bottom, curling his tail around his body in a protective gesture.
What a thing to say.
I mostly mean it, Luna said.
Furion fluttered from girl to monster and monster to girl. He didn't know where to land.
Come, Furion, Luna said, opening one of her side pockets. You can take a nap, and I will walk us up to the ridge to see if we can see my grandmother on her journey. We can see terribly far from up there.
You won't be able to see her yet. Not for days.
Lurk looked closely at the girl. There was something off today. He couldn't put his finger on it.
You never know, Luna said, turning on her heel and walking up the trail.
Patience has no wing, Lurk recited as she walked. Patience does not run, nor blow, nor skitter, nor falter. Patience is the swell of the ocean. Patience is the sigh of the mountain. Patience is the shir of the bog. Patience is the chorus of stars, infinitely singing.
I am not listening to you, Luna called without turning around.
But she was. Glurk could tell. By the time Luna reached the bottom of the slope, Furion was already asleep. That dragon could sleep anywhere and any time. He was an expert sleeper. Luna reached into her pocket and gave his head a gentle tap. He didn't wake up.
Dragons, Luna muttered.
This was the given answer to many of her questions, though it didn't always make very much sense. When Luna was little, Furion was older than she. That was obvious. He taught her to count, to add and subtract, and to multiply and divide. He taught her how to make numbers into something larger than themselves, applying them to larger concepts about motion and force, space and time, curves and circles and tightened springs. But now it was different. Furion seemed younger and younger every day. Sometimes it seemed to Luna that he was going backward in time while she stood still. But other times it seemed that the opposite was true. It was Furion who was standing still while Luna raced forward. She wondered why this was.
Dragons,
Glurk would explain.
Dragons,
Zan would agree. They both shrugged. Dragons, it was decided. What can one do? Which never actually answered anything. At least Furion never attempted to deflect or obfuscate Luna's many questions. Firstly, because he had no idea what obfuscate meant, and secondly, because he rarely knew any answers, unless they pertained to mathematics. Then he was a fountain of answers. For everything else, he was just Furion, and that was enough. Luna reached the top of the ridge before noon. She curled her fingers over her eyes and tried to look out as far as she could. She had never been this high before. She was amazed Glurk had let her go. The cities lay on the other side of the forest, down the slow southern slope of the mountain where the land became stable and flat, where the earth no longer was trying to kill you. Beyond that, Luna knew, were farms and more forests and more mountains and eventually an ocean. But Luna had never been that far. On the other side of her mountain, to the north,
There was nothing but forest, and beyond that was a bog that covered half the world. Glurk told her that the world was born out of that bog.
How?
Luna had asked a thousand times.
A poem, Glurk sometimes said. A song,
he said at other times. And then, instead of explaining further, he told her she'd understand someday. Glurk, Luna decided, was horrible. Everyone was horrible. And most horrible was the pain in her head that had been getting worse all day. She sat down on the ground and closed her eyes. In the darkness behind her eyelids, she could see a blue color with a shimmer of silver at the edges, along with something else entirely. A hard, dense something like a nut. And what's more, the something seemed to be pulsing, as though it contained intricate clockwork. Click, click, click. Each click brings me closer to the close, Luna thought. She shook her head. Why would she think that? She had no idea. The close of what? She wondered. But there was no answer. And all of a sudden, she had an image in her head of a house with hand-stitched quilts draped on the chairs, and art on the walls, and colorful jars arranged on shelves in bright, tempting rows, and a woman with black hair and a crescent moon birthmark on her forehead, and a man's voice crooning, "Do you see your mama? Do you, my darling?" And that word in her mind, echoing from one side of her skull to the other, "Mama, mama, mama," over and over and over again, like the cry of a faraway bird.
"Luna," Therian said, "why are you crying?"
"I'm not crying," Luna said, wiping her tears away. "And anyway, I just miss my grandmama, that's all." And that was true. She did miss her. No amount of standing and staring was going to change the amount of time that it takes to walk from the free cities to their home at the top of the sleeping volcano. That was certain. But the house and the quilts and the woman with the black hair, Luna had seen them before. But she didn't know where. She looked down toward the swamp and the barn and the workshop and the treehouse, with its round windows peering out from the sides of the massive tree trunk like astonished, unblinking eyes. There was another house, and another family, before this house, and this family. She knew it in her bones.
"Luna, what is wrong?"
Therian asked, a note of anguish in his voice.
"Nothing, Therian," Luna said, curling her hands around his midsection and pulling him close. She kissed the top of his head. "Nothing at all. I'm just thinking about how much I love my family."
It was the first lie she ever told, even though her words were true. Chapter 18, In Which a Witch is Discovered. Zan couldn't remember the last time she had traveled so slowly. Her magic had been dwindling for years, but there was no denying that it was happening more quickly now. Now the magic seemed to have thinned into a tiny trickle, dripping through a narrow channel in her porous bones. Her vision dimmed, her hearing blurred. Her hip pained her, and her left foot, and her lower back, and her shoulders, and her wrists, and, weirdly, her nose. And her condition was only about to get worse. Soon, she would be holding Luna's hand for the last time, touching her face for the last time, speaking her words of love in the hoarsest of whispers. It was almost too much to bear. In truth, Zan was not afraid to die. Why should she be? She had helped ease the pain of hundreds and thousands of people in preparation for that journey into the unknown. She had seen enough times in the faces of those in their final moments a sudden look of surprise and a wild, mad joy. Zan felt confident that she had nothing to fear. Still, it was the before that gave her pause. The months leading her toward the end she knew would be far from dignified. When she was able to call up memories of Zazimos, still difficult despite her best efforts, they were of his grimace, his shudder, his alarming thinness. She remembered the pain he had been in, and she did not relish following in his footsteps. "It is for Luna," she told herself. "Everything, everything is for Luna." And it was true.
She loved that girl with every ache in her back. She loved her with every hacking cough. She loved her with every rheumatic sigh. She loved her with every crack in her joints. There was nothing she would not endure for that girl. And she needed to tell her. Of course she did. Soon, she told herself. Not yet. The Protectorate sat at the bottom of a long, gentle slope, right before the slope opened up into the vast Zirin bog. Zan climbed up a rocky outcropping to catch a view of the town before her final descent. There was something about that town, the way its many sorrows lingered in the air, as persistent as fog. Standing far above the sorrow cloud, Zan, in her clear-headedness, chastised herself. "Old fool," she muttered. "How many people have you helped? How many wounds have you healed and hearts have you soothed? How many souls have you guided on their way? And yet here are these poor people, men and women and children, that you have refused to help. What do you have to say for yourself, you silly woman?" She had nothing to say for herself. And she still didn't know why. She only knew that the closer she got, the more desperate she felt to leave. She shook her head, brushed the gravel and leaves from her skirts, and continued down the slope toward the town. As she walked, she had a memory. She could remember her room in the old castle, her favorite room, with the two dragons carved in stone on either side of the fireplace, and a broken ceiling, open to the sky, but magicked to keep the rain away. And she could remember climbing into her makeshift bed and clutching her hands to her heart, praying to the stars that she might have a night free from bad dreams. She never did. And she could remember weeping into her mattress, great gushes of tears. And she could remember a voice at the other side of the door, a quiet, dry, scratchy voice whispering, "More, more, more." Zan pulled her cloak tightly around her arms. She didn't like being cold. She also didn't like remembering things. She shook her head to clear away the thoughts and marched down the slope into the cloud. The madwoman in the tower saw the witch hobbling through the trees. She was far away, ever so far, but the madwoman's eyes could see around the world if she let them. Had she known how to do this before she went mad? Perhaps she had. Perhaps she simply didn't notice. She had been a devoted daughter once, and then a girl in love, and then an expectant mother counting the days until her baby came. And then everything had gone wrong. The madwoman discovered that it was possible for her to know things, impossible things. The world, she knew in her madness, was littered with shiny bits and precious pieces. A man might drop a coin on the ground and never find it again, but a crow will find it in a flash. Knowledge, in its essence, was a glittering jewel, and the madwoman was a crow. She pressed, reached, picked, and gathered. She knew so many things. She knew where the witch lived, for example. She could walk there blindfolded if she could just get out of the tower for long enough. She knew where the witch took the children. She knew what those towns were like. "How is our patient doing this morning?" the head sister said to her at the dawning of each day. "How much sorrow presses on her poor, poor soul?" She was hungry. The madwoman could feel it. "None," the madwoman could have said if she felt like speaking, but she didn't. For years the madwoman's sorrows had fed the head sister. For years she felt the predatory pounce. Sorrow eater, the madwoman discovered herself knowing. It was not a term that she had ever learned. She found it the way she found anything that was useful. She reached through the gaps of the world and worried it out. For years she lay silently in her cell while the head sister gorged herself on sorrow, and then one day there was no sorrow to be had. The madwoman learned to lock it away, seal it off with something else. Hope. And more, Sister Ignatia went away hungry. "Clever," the sister said, her mouth a thin, grim line. "You have locked me out. For now."
"You have locked me in."
the mad woman thought, a tiny spark of hope igniting in her soul. For now. The mad woman pressed her face to the thick bars in her thin window. The witch had left the outcropping and was right now limping toward the town walls, just as the council was carrying the latest baby to the gates. No mother wailed. No father screamed. They didn't fight for their doomed child. They watched, numbly, as the infant was carried into the horrors of the forest, believing it would keep those horrors away. They set their faces and stared at fear. "Fools," the mad woman wanted to tell them. "You are looking the wrong way." The mad woman folded a map into the shape of a falcon. There were things that she could make happen, things that she couldn't explain. This was true before they came for her baby, before the tower. One measure of wheat would become two. Fabric, worn thin as paper, would become thick and luxurious in her hands. But slowly, during her long years in the tower, her gifts had become sharp and clear. She found bits and pieces of magic in the gaps of the world and squirreled them away. The mad woman took aim. The witch was heading for the clearing. The elders were heading for the clearing. And the falcon would fly directly to where the baby was. She knew it in her bones. Grand Elder Gerland was, it was true, getting on in years. The potions he received every week from the Sisters of the Star helped, but these days they seemed to help less than usual. And it annoyed him. And the business with the babies annoyed him, too. Not the concept of it, really, nor the results. He simply didn't enjoy touching babies. They were loud, boorish, and, frankly, selfish. Plus, they stank. The one he held now certainly did. Gravitas was all fine and good, and it was important to maintain appearances, but Gerland shifted the baby from one arm to the other. He was getting too old for this sort of thing. He missed Antane. He knew he was being silly. It was better this way, with the boy gone. Executions are a messy business, after all, especially when family is involved. Still, as much as Antane's irrational resistance to the day of sacrifice had irritated Gerland to no end, he felt they had lost something when Antane resigned, though he couldn't say exactly what. The council felt empty with Antane gone. He told himself that he just wanted someone else to hold the wriggling brat, but Gerland knew there was more to the feeling than that. The people along the walkway bowed their heads as the council walked by, which was all fine and good. The baby wriggled and squirmed. It spat up on Gerland's robes. Gerland sighed deeply. He would not make a scene. He owed it to his people to take these discomforts in stride. It was difficult. No one would ever know how difficult. To be this beloved and honorable and selfless. And as the council swept through the final causeway, Gerland made sure to congratulate himself for his kind, humanitarian nature. The baby's wails devolved into self-indulgent hiccups. "Ingrate," muttered Gerland. Antane made sure he was seen on the road as the council walked by. He made brief eye contact with his Uncle Gerland. "Awful man," he thought with a shudder, and then slipped out behind the crowd and hooked through the gate when no one was looking. Once under the cover of the trees, he headed toward the clearing at a run. Athene was still standing on the side of the road. She had a basket ready for the grieving family. She was an angel, a treasure, and was now, incredibly, Antane's wife, and had been since a month after she left the tower, and they loved one another desperately, and they wanted a family, but the woman in the rafters, the cry of the baby, the cloud of sorrow hanging over the protectorate like a fog. Antane had watched that horror unfold and had done nothing. He had stood by as baby after baby was taken and left in the forest. "We couldn't stop it if we tried," he had told himself. It's what everyone told themselves. It's what Antane had always believed. But Antane had also believed that he would spend his life alone and lonely. And then love proved him wrong. And now the world was brighter than it was before. If that belief could be proved wrong, could not others be as well? What if we're wrong about the witch?
What if we're wrong about the sacrifice? Antane wondered. The question itself was revolutionary and astonishing. What would happen if we tried?
Why had the thought never occurred to him before?
Wouldn't it be better, he thought, to bring a child into a world that was good and fair and kind? Had anyone ever tried to talk to the witch? How did they know she couldn't be reasoned with? Anyone that old, after all, had to have a little bit of wisdom. It only made sense. Love made him giddy. Love made him brave. Love made foggy questions clearer, and Antane needed answers. He rushed past the ancient sycamore trees and hid himself in the bushes, waiting for the old men to leave. It was there he found the paper falcon, hanging like an ornament in the yew bush. He grabbed it and held it close to his heart. By the time Zan reached the clearing, she was already late. She could hear that baby fussing from half a league away. "Auntie Zan is coming, dearest," she called out. "Please don't fret." She couldn't believe it. After all these years, she had never been late. Never. The poor little thing. She closed her eyes tight and tried to send a flood of magic into her legs to give them a little more speed. Alas, it was more like a puddle than a flood, but it did help a bit. Using her cane to spring her forward, Zan sprinted through the green. "Oh, thank goodness," she breathed when she saw the baby, red-faced and enraged, but alive and unharmed. "I was so worried about you, I—" And then a man stepped between her and the child. "Stop," he cried. He had a heavily scarred face and a weapon in his hands. The puddle of magic, compounded now with fear and surprise and worry for the child that was on the other side of this dangerous stranger, enlarged suddenly into a tidal wave. It thrummed through Zan's bones, lighting her muscles and tissues and skin. Even her hair sizzled with magic. "Out of my way!" Zan shouted, her voice rumbling through the rocks. She could feel her magic rush from the center of the earth, through her feet and out the top of her head on its way to the sky, back and forth and back and forth, like massive waves pushing and pulling at the shore. She reached out and grabbed the man with both hands. He cried out as a surge hit him square in the solar plexus, knocking his breath clear away. Zan flung him aside as easily as if he was a rag doll. She transformed herself into an astonishingly large hawk, descended on the child, gripped the swaddling clothes in her talons, and lifted the baby into the sky. Zan couldn't stay that way. She just didn't have enough magic. But she and the child could stay airborne over at least the next two ridges. Then she would give food and comfort, assuming she didn't collapse first. The child opened its throat and wailed. The mad woman in the tower watched the witch transform. She felt nothing as she watched the old nose harden into a beak. She felt nothing as she saw the feathers erupt from her pores, as her arms widened and her body shortened, and the old woman screamed in power and pain. The mad woman remembered the weight of an infant in her arms, the smell of the scalp, the joyful kick of a brand new pair of legs, the astonished waving of tiny hands. She remembered bracing her back against the roof. She remembered her feet on the rafters. She remembered wanting to fly. "Birds," she murmured as the witch took flight. "Birds, birds, birds." There is no time in the tower. There is only loss. "For now," she thought. She watched the young man, the one with the scars on his face. Pity about the scar, she hadn't meant to do it. But he was a kind boy, clever, curious, and good of heart. His kindness was his dearest currency. His scars, she knew, had kept the silly girls away. He deserved someone extraordinary to love him. She watched him stare at the paper falcon. She watched him carefully unfold each tight crease and flatten the paper on a stone. The paper had no map. Instead, it had words. "Don't forget," it said on one side. "I mean it," said the other. And in her soul,
The madwoman felt 1,000 birds. Birds of paper, birds of feathers, birds of hearts and minds and flesh leap into the sky and soar over the dreaming trees. Chapter 19, in which there is a journey to the town of agony. For the people who loved Luna, time passed in a blur. Luna, however, worried that she might never be 12. Each day felt like a heavy stone to be hoisted to the top of a very tall mountain. In the meantime, each day increased her knowledge. Each day caused the world to simultaneously expand and contract. The more Luna knew, the more she became frustrated by what she did not yet know. She was a quick study and quick-fingered and quick-footed and sometimes quick-tempered. She cared for the goats and cared for the chickens and cared for her grandmother and her dragon and her swamp monster. She knew how to coax milk and gather eggs and bake bread and fashion inventions and build contraptions and grow plants and press cheese and simmer a stew to nourish the mind and the soul. She knew how to keep the house tidy, though she didn't like that job much, and how to stitch birds onto the hem of a dress to make it delightful. She was a bright child, an accomplished child, a child who loved and was loved. And yet, there was something missing, a gap in her knowledge, a gap in her life. Luna could feel it. She hoped that turning 12 would solve this, build a bridge across the gap. It didn't. Instead, once she finally did turn 12, Luna noticed that several changes had begun to occur, not all of them pleasant. She was, for the first time, taller than her grandmother. She was more distractible, impatient, peevish. She snapped at her grandmother. She snapped at her swamp monster. She even snapped at her dragon, who is as close to her heart as a twin brother. She apologized to all of them, of course, but the fact of it happening was itself an irritation. Why was everyone vexing her so? Luna wondered. And another thing. While Luna had always believed that she had read every single book in the workshop, she began to realize that there were several more that she had never read at all. She knew what they looked like. She knew where they sat on the shelf. But try as she might, she could not picture their titles, nor remember a single clue as to their contents. And what's more, she found that she could not even read the words on the spines of certain volumes. She should have been able to read them. The words were not foreign, and the letters hooked into one another in ways that ought to have made perfect sense. And yet, every time she tried to look at the spines, her eyes would slide from one side to the other, as though they were not made of leather and ink, but of glass slicked with oil. It didn't happen when she looked at the spine of The Lives of a Star, and it didn't happen when she looked at the beloved copy of Mechanica. But other books, they were as slippery as marbles in butter. And what's more, whenever she reached for one of them, she would find herself unaccountably lost in a memory or a dream. She would find herself going cross-eyed and fuzzy-headed, whispering poetry or making up a story. Sometimes she would regain her senses minutes or hours or half a day later, shaking her head to unaddle her brains and wondering what on earth she had been doing or for how long. She didn't tell anyone about these spells, not her grandmother, not Glurk, certainly not Furion. She didn't want to worry any of them. These changes were too embarrassing, too strange, and so she kept it secret. Even still, they sometimes gave her strange looks or odd answers to her questions, as if they already knew something was wrong with her. And that wrongness clung to her like a headache that she couldn't shake. Another thing that happened after Luna turned 12, she began to draw, all the time. She drew both mindlessly and mindfully. She drew faces, places, and minute details of plants and animals, a stamen here, a paw there, the rotted-out tooth of an aged goat. She drew star maps and maps of the free cities and maps of places that existed only in her imagination. She drew a tower with unsettling stonework and intersecting corridors and stairways crowding its insides, looming over a town drenched in fog. She drew a woman with long black hair and a man in robes. It was all her grandmother could do to keep her in paper and quills. Firion and Glurk took to making her pencils from charcoal and stiff reeds. She could never get enough. Later that year, Luna and her grandmother walked to the Free Cities again. Her grandmother was always in high demand. She checked in on the pregnant women and gave advice to the midwives and healers and apothecaries. And while Luna loved visiting the towns on the other side of the forest, this time the journey also vexed her. Her grandmother, as stable as a boulder all of Luna's life, was starting to weaken. Luna's increasing worry for her grandmother's health pricked at her skin like a dress made of thorns. Zan had been limping the whole way, and it was getting worse. "Grandmama," Luna said, watching her grandmother wince with each step, "why are you still walking? You should be sitting. I think you should sit down right now. Oh, look, a log for sitting on." "Oh, tosh," her grandmother said, leaning heavily on her staff and wincing again. "The more I sit, the longer the journey will take us." "The more you walk, the more pain you'll be in," Luna countered. Every morning, it seemed, Zan had a new ache or a new pain, a cloudiness in the eye or a droop to his shoulder. Luna was beside herself. "Do you want me to sit on your feet, Grandmama?" she asked Zan. "Do you want me to tell you a story or sing you a song?" "What has gotten into you, child?" Luna's grandmother sighed. "Maybe you should eat something or drink something. Maybe you should have some tea. Would you like me to make you tea? Perhaps you should sit down for tea." "I'm perfectly fine. I have made this trip more times than I can count, and I have never had any trouble. You are making a fuss over nothing." But Luna knew something was changing in her grandmother. There was a tremor in her voice and a tremble in her hands, and she was so thin. Luna's grandmother used to be bulbous and squat, all soft hugs and squishy cuddles. Now she was fragile and delicate and light. Dry grasses wrapped in crumbling paper that might fall apart in a gust of wind. When they arrived in the town called Agony, Luna ran ahead to the widow woman's house just at the border. "My grandmother's not well," Luna told the widow woman. "Don't tell her I said so." And the widow woman sent her almost grown-up son, a star child like so many others, who ran to the healer, who ran to the apothecary, who ran to the mayor, who alerted the League of Ladies, who alerted the Gentlemen's Association and the Clockmakers' Alliance and the Quilters and the Tinkers and the town school. By the time Zan hobbled into the widow woman's garden, half the town was already there, setting up tables and tents, with legions upon legions of busybodies preparing themselves to fuss over the old woman. "Foolishness," Zan sniffed, though she lowered herself gratefully into the chair that a young woman placed right next to the herb garden for her. "We thought it best," the widow woman said. "I thought it best," corrected Luna, and what seemed like a thousand hands caressed her cheeks and the top of her head and her shoulders. "Such a good girl," the townspeople murmured. "We knew she would be the best of best girls and the best of best children and one day the best of best women. We do so love being right." This attention wasn't unusual. Whenever Luna visited the Free Cities, she found herself warmly received and fawned over. She didn't know why the townspeople loved her so, or why they seemed to hang on her every word, but she enjoyed their admiration. They remarked at her fine eyes, dark and glittering as the night sky, her black hair shot with gold, the birthmark on her forehead in the shape of a crescent moon. They remarked on her intelligent fingers and her strong arms and her fast legs. They praised her for her precise way of speaking and her clever gestures when she danced and her lovely singing voice. "She sounds like magic," the town matron sighed, and then Zan shot them a poisonous look at which they started mumbling about the weather. That word made Luna frown. In that moment, she knew she must have heard it before. She must have. But a moment later, the word flew out of her mind like a hummingbird, and then it was gone. Just a blank space was left where the word had been, like a fleeting thought at the edge of a dream. Luna sat among a collection of star children,
all different ages, one infant, some toddlers, and moving upward to the oldest, who was an impressively old man.
"Why are they called star children?" Luna had asked possibly thousands of times.
"I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about," Zan answered vaguely,
and then she changed the subject, and then Luna forgot, every time. Only lately, she could remember herself forgetting. The star children were discussing their earliest memories. It was a thing they did often, seeing which one could get as close as possible to the moment when old Zan brought them to their families and marked them as beloved. Since no one could actually remember such a thing, they had been far too young. They went as deep into their memories as they could to find the earliest image among them.
"I can remember a tooth, how it became wiggly and fell out. Everything before that is a bit of a blur, I'm afraid," said the older star child gentleman.
"I can remember a song that my mother used to sing, but she still sings it, so perhaps it isn't a memory after all," said a girl.
"I remember a goat with a crinkly mane," said a boy.
"Are you sure that wasn't just old Zan?" a girl asked him, giggling. She was one of the younger star children.
"Oh," the boy said, "perhaps you're right."
Luna wrinkled her brow. There were images lurking in the back of her mind. Were they memories or dreams? Or memories of memories? Or perhaps she had made them up. How was she supposed to know? She cleared her throat. "There was an old man," she said, "with dark robes that made a swishing sound like the wind, and he had a wobbly neck and a nose like a vulture, and he didn't like me very much." The star children cocked their heads.
"Really?"
one of the boys said.
"Are you sure?"
They stared at her intently, curling their lips between their teeth and biting down. Zan waved her left hand dismissively while her cheeks began to flush from pink to scarlet.
"Don't listen to her," Zan rolled her eyes. "She has no idea what she's talking about. There was no such man. We see lots of silly things when we dream."
Luna closed her eyes. "And there was a woman who lived on the ceiling whose hair waved like the branches of the sycamore trees in a storm."
"Impossible," her grandmother scoffed. "You don't know anyone that I didn't meet first. I was there for your whole life."
She gazed at Luna with a narrowed eye.
"And a boy who smelled like sawdust. Why would he smell like sawdust?"
"Lots of people smell like sawdust," her grandmother said. "Woodcutters, carpenters, the lady who carves spoons. I could go on and on."
This was true, of course, and Luna had to shake her head. The memory was old and far away, but at the same time, clear. Luna didn't have very many memories that were as tenacious as this one. Her memory typically was a slippery thing and difficult to pin down, and so she hung on to it. This image meant something. She was sure of it. Her grandmother, now that she thought about it, never spoke of memories. Not ever. The next day, after sleeping in the guest room of the widow woman, Zan walked through the town, checking on the pregnant women, advising them on their work level and food choices, listening to their bellies. Luna tagged along.
"So you may learn something useful," her grandmother said.
Her words stung, no mistake.
"I'm useful," Luna said, tripping on the cobblestones as they hurried to the first patient's house on the other edge of town.
The woman's pregnancy was so far along, she looked as though she might burst at any second. She greeted both grandmother and grandchild with a serene exhaustion.
"I'd get up," she said, "but I fear I may fall over."
Luna kissed the lady on the cheek, as was customary, and quickly touched the mound of belly, feeling the child leap inside. Suddenly she had a lump in her throat.
"Why don't I make some tea?" she said briskly, turning her face away. "I had a mother once," Luna thought. "I must have." She frowned. And surely she must have asked about it too, but she couldn't seem to remember doing so.
Luna made a list of what she knew in her head.
Sorrow is dangerous. Memories are slippery. My grandmother does not always tell the truth. And neither do I.
These thoughts swirled in Luna's